Okay, Boker Tov, if you want to just get... Oh. In Toronto.
Okay. Everybody's heard all my shtick, right?
I don't know if I talk about that. In Toronto, but the Toronto stuff I don't know, but okay.
Oh, good, you're here. They're at the end of my slides.
Okay. Okay, Boker Tov, everybody, and Shavua Tov. I don't know if I should begin with Shachiyanu v'kimanu v'hegiyanu l'zman hazeh, but this is the first in-person program we've done in 3 years. And the last, since our last program, February of 2020, we had about, 1,400 classes on Zoom, Baruch Hashem, and hundreds of thousands of people have come, but this is the first time we're back live at a program, so I want to thank you for coming in person. And of course, I want to thank Ellie and Renee Rubenstein, who are sponsoring our program this morning. You know, last week, Naomi told me that it's Sarah Schneer's Yortzeit was today. I had no idea. And you had no idea when we thought of the program. Nobody looked at the Hebrew date. I don't know when Sarah Schneer's Yortzeit is at Chatai and Imaskir Hayom, but Naomi told me last week it's Sarah Schneer's Yortzeit. I said, amazing, amazing. And then Renee called me last week when she saw the program that it's her mother's Yortzeit, and she would like to sponsor the program with her sister, Chadni Bronstein, in memory, Lilui Nishmat Miriam Batchana Umenachem Mendel. And her mother was a student, Magda Reichner, was a student of in Beis Yaakov in Bratislava, which was established by Chava Landsberg, who was a student of Sarah Schneer. So I think bring it all together. Thank you. You should have good memories, long life, the neshama should have an aliyah. And thank you very much for your support over all the years of Torah Motion. Thank you very much. What I'll briefly do, since we have three speakers and these are speaking for a relatively short amount of time, then we'll have a question and answer period. I'll briefly introduce all three speakers now, but we won't have to do in the middle. Dr. Naomi Seidman is the Chancellor, Jackman Professor of Arts in the Department of Study of Religion and the Center of Diaspora and Transnational Studies at the University of Toronto. Is there a shortened version? She's a professor at the University of Toronto. That she's a professor at the University of Toronto. She's an alumnus of Beis Yaakov of Borough Park, and has spent the last number of years, many years, really becoming the world's expert on the history of Beis Yaakov. Her book, Sarah Schneer and the Beis Yaakov Movement, A Revolution in the Name of Tradition, was published in 2019 by Litman Library, and she won the National Jewish Book Award in Women's Studies, and it's really a pleasure. Her chain, we've had her speak on Zoom, actually, and it's really a pleasure to meet in person. So thank you very much. Our second speaker, who is a research assistant with Dr. Naomi, is Chaya Juni. Chaya Juni, who is a graduate of Beis Yaakov in Toronto, and also meets Reshet Lindenbaum in Israel, and is now a second-year student of philosophy and English literature at University of Toronto, and working as a research assistant on the Beis Yaakov project. So a pleasure to have you. Thank you very much. And our third speaker, Dr. Kamen Weiser, is a Silver Family Professor of Modern Jewish Studies and Director of the Israel and Golda Koschitzky Center for Jewish Studies at York University. He's a graduate of Yale and Columbia. He's author of numerous books, but he'll be speaking on Yiddish in the archive, so I'll mention his book, Jewish People, Yiddish Nation, Noah Prulucki. That's my Yiddish. And the folk list in Poland won the 2000 Canadian Jewish Book Award for scholarship, and it's a pleasure to have everybody here. That's enough introduction. Dr. Seidman, Vakasha.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you to Rabbi J. Kelman, a fellow who's Shatner, right?
Yes.
We both happen
to...
Right. We both know the same tune for Kol Mekadeshvi, but we're not going to sing it now. That was yesterday or 2 days ago. And who else? Thank you for coming. I actually know a few people here, especially thank you to the Berenbaum family, the lovely, amazing Berenbaum family. You're going to be hearing a lot more about them mostly from Kalman. And thank you to Renee and Eli Rubenstein for sponsoring this. And who am I forgetting, Kalman? Thank you to Kalman for driving me. Thank you to Chaya Chaya for working so hard with me till I think it was a quarter to midnight on Thursday night. So I don't have so much time. You know what it means when a Jewish studies professor takes off her watch? Nothing. Sorry, that's an old one. Sorry to everybody who's like heard all my shtick before. Hear it again, as my father used to say. So I'm going to be introducing this project. I wrote a book about called Sarah Schneer and the Beis Yaakov Movement that came out in 2019. And apparently I'm not done. Apparently, you know, I'm not done with Beis Yaakov. It was, since then I've gotten a research grant from the Canadian, the SHRC, the Social Science and Humanities Research Council of Canada. This is where you break into O Canada. One of the amazing things about being a Canadian professor as opposed to being an American professor is that there's a lot more research funding from the government. I don't know if you know this. So there's more money to play with, and one of the things, and I'll talk about what it is that I'm doing with the Beis Yaakov and Beis Yaakov project. But as Rabbi Kelman said, today is Sarah Schneer's Yahrzeit. And I'll start by talking about how I got involved in this research project to begin with, which goes back to 2010. So in 2010, I used to teach in a Christian divinity school in Berkeley, California, and I was in Krakow for the Jewish Culture Festival with a group of about 8 students. And I was in the courtyard of the Ramah Synagogue. Some of you know this amazing, I think, 16th century synagogue, and it's still intact in Krakow. And I saw a bunch of Beis Yaakov girls, and, you know, dressed like Beis Yaakov girls. They didn't recognize me, but I could tell a Beis Yaakov girl a mile off. And I said, "What are you in town for the festival?" And they said, "Actually, we're here to visit the grave of the woman who started our school system." And I said, "Oh, Sarah Schneer is buried in Krakow?" I should have known, but I didn't. And they looked at me like, "You know who Sarah Schneer is?" And I'm like, "Of course I know who Sarah Schneer is." And as I was walking back to my hotel, I bumped into Janosch Makuch, who's the director of the Jewish Culture Festival. Has anyone ever been to the Jewish Culture Festival in Krakow? It's the most amazing Jewish thing you've ever seen, and it's run by a non-Jew named Janosch. He's been doing it since the Soviet era. He said, "What do you are you having a good time?" And I said, "You know, I just bumped into a group of these Orthodox teenagers, and they're here, a pilgrimage to this woman's. Do you know anything about this? I mean, do you know that there's these Orthodox girls coming through Krakow on their way probably between the seminary in Israel and, you know, their homes in Brooklyn, most of them?" And he said, "No, I had no idea. Do you want to give a talk about it at the festival next year?" And of course I did, right? Like, I wanted to be on the inside of the festival and not on the outside of the festival. So I spent a year trying to find out about this pilgrimage practice, which was a new pilgrimage practice since I myself was a Beis Yaakov girl. And I gave the talk, and there was someone in the audience who gave me her card, Connie Weber. She said, "You should write a book." So I wrote a book. But I'm still not done, as I said. So that's how this all started. And for those of you who don't know, this is the image of Sarah Schneer, the founder of Beis Yaakov. How many people went to Beis Yaakov here? Yay! So you're probably, when I started to write the book, this picture was not known. Sarah Schneer famously did not want her photograph circulated. And this is a picture that was in the Krakow archive. It's a application for her ID card. And I wanted to respect her wishes, but also I'm a historian, and also I do these shows. So the compromise that I gave myself is that I do her picture very small. And this is the picture that circulated with her permission. It was the frontispiece of her collected writings that came out in 1933. So this, I feel okay showing you a little larger. And this is, you know, the famous, amazing growth of the Beis Yaakov system. And I'll just point out that it wasn't until February of 1925 that this movement was actually taken over by the Agudas Yisrael, the World Organization of Orthodox Jews. So until 1925, let's say 40 schools or more, put together by one woman, basically on her own, with the help of a few local Aguda people. So this is a quite astonishing story. Talk a lot more about this, but time is short. So I'll just, this is my favorite map until the map that I'm going to tell you about. So this map was done in 1931, and it's a map that was, I love these old maps. I think that's the main reason I'm in this business, is because I love old maps. But this map was put together by a group of visiting Aguda administrators from Central Europe, you know, Austria and Germany, mostly. And they came, there's a picture of them on the top right. They came to visit the system and also to visit the Chafetz Chaim and just to, you know, a tour of Eastern Europe, which they were supporting a lot of institutions in this part of the world. And this picture was produced during this tour. By this point, Beis Yaakov was already an international movement. There were this many schools, whatever that is, in, well, you can see there, Austria, Czechoslovakia, and Renee's mother, right, went to the seminary in Bratislava, which I think was founded in 1936. And my mother was in the, so by the time, so I'll just give a little detour here, which is that by this era, there were, by 1931, there were already two seminaries, teacher seminaries in this system. And one was the main one in Krakow, which had its own building by 1931, which still is standing. And the other one was in Vienna, which didn't have its own building. And by 1935, 36, there were already, there was one in Bratislava and there was one in Czernowitz. My mother went to the one in Czernowitz. Your mother went to the one in Bratislava. So, and one reason I wanted to show you this map, other than I love it, is that one of the things that we're spending your tax money on is that we're producing a map of all the Beis Yaakovs in the world ever, from the beginning till now, and it'll be a kind of map where you can click on 1929, see all the schools in 1929, click on the school that your mother went to or grandmother and see who was the principal there, any photographs we have, etc. And the other thing, and so, and this requires people traveling all around the world. Chai is just one of, it's like I'm running a little business. Chai is just one of the people employed by me. I have another one, if anyone knows him, Marinka Yosifon, who's a Spanish speaker, who's in Buenos Aires right now. There are five Beis Yaakovs in Buenos Aires. So this is what we're doing. And this was supposed to be year one of the grant, and that was like 3 years ago, and it's we're about to unroll this map, but it's not quite ready yet. There were Beis Yaakovs in Uruguay. There were Beis Yaakovs, I mean, just we're finding everyone that ever existed. The oldest Beis Yaakov in the world, continuous, more or less continuously running with a little, anyone know? What? No, Bill Winsor is 1937, 1934, Antwerp. This is, oh, did I say Beis Yaakov was the, it started as Yisodei HaTorah in 1896, became a Beis Yaakov in 1934, is still a Beis Yaakov now. We have to send someone to Antwerp. The Beis Yaakov Journal, and, you know, there's Uriel Birnbaum's beautiful, what's it called? Ink? What is it? It's an ink drawing, which I found, which was probably not an illustration for Beis Yaakov, but I did find it illustrating some Beis Yaakov publications. Beis Yaakov, by the way, was the largest independent non-public school system in interwar Poland. So it was larger than Tarbut or Cisho or these secular ones, etc. So it was the largest one, and it was only a girls' school. So if you can, you could see how that's really significant. The Beis Yaakov Journal is the longest running Yiddish women's, there were quite a few women's journals, magazines, etc. The Beis Yaakov Journal came out in, I think, 150-something issues between 1923 and 1939, even before Beis Yaakov was taken over by the Aguda. It was kind of adopted by a young Aguda activist named Gershon Friedenson, who was the editor-in-chief. His son was Yossel Friedenson. Okay, I realize this is real inside baseball. There's people here who know all these names, and the rest of you, they're just Jewish names going in and out your ears. Okay, so what am I doing now that the book is done? So one of the things I'm doing, along with all the other crazy things that we're doing, is in the archives, in the Evo archive, I don't think it's in the Berenbaum archive, is a songbook from 1931 that has a bunch of Beis Yaakov songs from the interwar period, including the notes. And we're making a record. I know, that's so 1990. But we're making a record of Beis Yaakov music. Basi Schechter, another graduate of Beis Yaakov Borough Park, who's a musician. We were just planning it on the phone a couple of days ago. Now is a good time for me to say that we're also having a conference tomorrow. If this isn't enough for you, a two-day conference, international, people coming from Poland, America, Israel, 18 people. And it's going to be 2 days of presentations about Beis Yaakov. And on Monday at 5:30, you can also Zoom in, we're going to have a concert of Beis Yaakov Beis Yaakov music. And because Kol Isha and all that, the singers you're going to see are all kind of like ex-Beis Yaakov people. But one of these days, we'll get a bunch of actual still Beis Yaakov inside people, and we'll have an all-women's concert, right, Chaya? So the other thing that I'm doing is we're focusing on, so one of the things that took a very little space in my book was the Beis Yaakov play. And the Beis Yaakov play, it seems like, okay, very nice. I'm realizing what a big deal the Beis Yaakov play is, that it's not a small extracurricular activity. For anyone, all the people here who went to Beis Yaakov, you know what a big deal it is, right? Production. So one of the things I discovered is that the production goes way back. The first, we have a production. Better to see that than me. Better to see these old people. So, these are Beis Yaakov plays from the 20s and 30s. It was already a huge deal, by which I mean in the Jewish newspapers, Sara Schneer's plays, 1920 in advertisement. I tried to get an image of it. Her first play was Yehudis, which is significant for those of you who know Beis Yaakov history, because she had her great revelation to start a Beis Yaakov at Rabbi Moshe David Flesch's Stumpfergastschule in Vienna on Shabbos Chanukah when he was giving a sermon about Yehudis. Her first play was about the biblical, extra-biblical character of Yehudis. Yehudis was a great smash hit in the Beis Yaakov circus. Why wouldn't it be a smash hit? You get to, at one point, Yehudis walks out with, what's his name, Holofernes's head. Holding it by the hair, though the actual beheading takes place off stage. And instead of him, like, coming on to her, it's almost like a shidduch scene, because it's a Beis Yaakov play. So Sara Schneer herself wrote 6 plays, and there are many other people writing plays. If you come, we're going to have an exhibit in the rare book room of Berenbaum material, but also Beis Yaakov material. We have Chana. We have a play, Chana and Her 7 Sons, by Sara Schneer, also a copy of a script, so you get to see that. And this is still, so one of the reasons why I like to show this, first of all, this is, I think, one of the most beautiful photographs into our period. And this is the Beis Yaakov of Buchach, and there are people, this is a Chanukah play. What's interesting is why Beis Yaakov so often did Chanukah plays as opposed to Purim plays. It's a whole other story I won't get into, but This, I think, actually is a Purim play. This is Munkach, by the way, for any Munkachers out there. But Buchach happened to be my father's hometown, and my book is dedicated to my aunt who died in the Holocaust, was murdered. Let's not use euphemisms here. And she was the Beis Yaakov teacher in Buchach, and we never had a photo of her. And this, I do not actually know whether that's my aunt over there. Oop, I just did something to my, oh no. Is that me? Did I do that? Sorry. I have a very loud voice. I don't need. Don't I? I think it might be that, no? Hi, Marina, sorry. It is off.
It is off, yeah, it's not her computer.
Can we turn this off?
Yeah, sure. This is the HDMI cable.
Yeah.
Does that also have audio?
He just turned that off. He pulled it out and put it back in again. He just did that. Oh my God. Thank you. Sorry about that. I Oh boy. Okay. Sorry. That's, by the way, my next project is Freud and Hebrew and Yiddish. Yeah, bring me back and I'll talk about that. My aunt, I was saying. I think that might be my aunt. I actually don't know for sure because my father's no longer alive. I'm scared. Oh, there, it's on. Okay, so, and for those of you who don't know, so this is a poster from 1926 for a Beis Yaakov play, Eingang Norfar Freuen. So right from the very start, so Sarah Schneerer asked the Belzer Rebbe for permission to put on plays around 1920, famously she got a bracha v'atzlacha from the Belzer Rebbe, her own Rebbe, so to speak. And he's, oh no. Did you just do something? I keep going? Or is it too late? Is it all over? Okay, should I go? So, I should say hi, everybody. Sorry about that. I'm sure it was me. I always think everything's always me. No, I know it wasn't me. That's just like automatic, you know. That, does anyone else have that? You know, this police, like, what did I do? I was just pointing out this poster from 1926. A Basiaco production, even in the 1920s, involved renting a movie theater or getting, these were not little school plays. And what you see here on the right is Basiakov Productions today. Some of them, I don't know how many of you know that there's a whole Orthodox women's film industry where these are, which is why there's no images of, there's no faces on those posters. That's how kosher they are. Which, by the way, the taboo against showing women's faces didn't exist in the interwar period, which is one of the things you learn if you do a little history. But anyway, right, Chaya? So, this is part of my new, what I'm trying to do is trace a history of Basiakov, let's call it, amateur theatrical production from the beginning until today, which is why the Canadian government is paying for Chaya to go to Basiakov plays and take very good notes. Chaya and Maxine, which she just did last week, right? So, and I also like go to Basiakov plays and put it on my research budget. They're not cheap, by the way, and there's a reason why they're not cheap. They're very elaborate, serious productions. Actually, at the conference, my talk, which you could come to campus and hear, or you could watch it on Zoom, I think it'll probably be on YouTube, from 4 to 6:30, is going to be about a newspaper story that I read about called When Aguda Began to Make Movies, with Basiakov girls as the movie stars. It turns out not to be a fictional story. I'm 95% sure that it was a joke. But until I thought I was, oh, that would be so amazing if I could find an old movie from the interwar period of with Sarah Schneer having written the script, which of course she would have because she was a script writer. I was saying that the Belzer Rebbe told her, you're not allowed to do production because chukas agoyim. So she didn't for a couple years, and then she got permission, I think from the Gerer Rebbe. I'm still trying to track that down. But for whatever reason, from the 1920s until today, Basiakov has had one of the things that gives it its distinctiveness as a culture is its interest in the performing arts. And this is really, in other words, Basiakov is not a, maybe this will explain the sort of lead into the next slide, Basiakov is not a female version of whatever yeshiva, my brother went to Karlin Stolin. Basiakov was not a female version of Karlin Stolin, let's just say. It was a different beast. So what does it mean that, in other words, when you have a society that's as sexually segregated as Orthodox Judaism, maybe one of the most sexually segregated societies there is, you develop a kind of distinctive women's culture. And this distinctive women's culture, you can call it patriarchal, you could talk about women's exclusion from Talmud study, but that's only looking at it from a negative perspective. When you look at it from the positive perspective, you say, what is enabled by the absence of men, even in a patriarchy, let's call it that? What becomes possible? What becomes possible if you are, not only are women not supposed to devote all their time from morning till night to Torah study, it's not even clear that they're allowed to do that. So then what do they do with their time? Obviously there can be a lot of learning, and there is a lot of learning, but aside from that, from the beginning, theater was a big part of it, And actually, girls from not religious families would beg their parents to go to Beis Yaakov's because they wanted to be in the play. The play was such a famous thing. It's also the boys were jealous of the girls, which is a good thing in a society. And sometimes they would try to sneak into the girls' plays by dressing like girls to get past the guards. And then they would get into the play dressed like women. And what they would see is girls on stage with fake beards. So it's a beautiful thing. Okay, so the last couple of things about Beis Yaakov is how to understand the character of Beis Yaakov. If you had to explain it in two slides, then I think what you would come up with is, first of all, Beis Yaakov, you have to understand that when Beis Yaakov was put under Sura Schnirer, there's Rabbi Moshe David Flesch, whose shul Sura Schnirer went to when she had the epiphany, according to her memoir, about starting a school system for girls or whatever the epiphany was. What she heard from him was a German-speaking rabbi who looked at girls and women, which Polish rabbis did not, and who spoke to them, who directed his sermon to the women in the congregation. She had never seen anything like that before, and who praised them. In Eastern Europe, the rabbis basically did that to women and didn't look at them even when they were doing that, right? It was like, be good, and I'm turning my back to you because I don't look at girls or women. So what she got was a certain kind of German-Jewish ability to have a relationship, a religious teaching relationship with girls and women. That's the first thing maybe she got out of it. And then she also got the teachings of Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, who directed his philosophical works and the idea of Torah Derech Eretz equally to men and women, boys and girls. His school, the Hirsch school system, was co-ed, even if in separate separate parts of the building. And when Sura Schnirer started her school system and when the Aguda took it up, the Aguda itself was a union of Eastern European, Rosh Yeshiva, Hasidic Rebbes, the Gerer Rebbe most famously. And that on the German side, it was these German speaker doctor rabbis who had university degrees and were modern Orthodox, maybe you would call it. And when the Aguda took over Beis Yaakov, they kind of outsourced it to the German rabbis because the German rabbis knew what to do with girls. Germany had already had a robust women's culture, Orthodox women's culture, including even books written directed to Jewish girls who otherwise were reading Polish romance novels and falling in love with Polish heroes of the romance novels. So you have Marcus Lehmann. And the other thing, I almost forgot this, German Jews had money, at least more than the Polish ones did. So Beis Yaakov got money and professionalization and leadership and philosophy and men who would look at women, look at women, that sounds not like what I mean, you know what I mean, right? Talk to them, lecture to them, get engaged with them, etc. They got professional advice from Germany. Bertha Pappenheim was on the board. The famous Bertha Pappenheim was also on my Freud project because she's Anna O, famous patient of Breuer. So basically what this means is that because of German influence, Beis Yaakov had a different character. Within the same family, the brother would be, you know, a yeshiva bacher, an Eastern European yeshiva bacher, a chassid, whatever. And the daughter would be a little bit more sophisticated, a little bit more philosophical, a little bit more likely to know foreign languages. You can almost say a little bit more modern, like whatever that denominational difference is between, I guess, this place and Beis Yaakov. I'm not really sure where we are in the spectrum here. But on the spectrum, I didn't mean that either. Where are we on the spectrum? I think this Or Chaim is like a little bit to the left of where my family was, maybe a lot. So the girls were themselves, so what's a denominational phenomenon became a gendered phenomenon in Eastern Europe. Does that make sense? Beis Yaakov had all these characteristics that it got because there were all these Germans involved in organizing it and Mengen. So on the other hand, oops, that's not the, here, this is the slide I was looking for. On the other hand, these are Eastern European Jewish girls. They come from Yiddish-speaking Hasidic homes often, not all of them, but a lot of them, right? Ger Hasidism is the main contributor to Beis Yaakov. The Ger Rebbe's daughter went to the seminary. So these are Hasidic girls. Sarah Schneer herself had a Hasidic soul. But what does it mean to be a Hasid if you're a woman in 1912 when she's writing her diary? How do you do it? You're not welcome at the court. You're more likely to be welcome at the court if you're Bertha Pappenheim, if you're like a German Jewish woman or even a non-Jewish woman, than if you're the daughter or a wife of a Hasid. They don't want you there. I mean, the courts are, Sarah Schneer spoke to the Belzer Rebbe. He had his back turned to her the whole time. Or maybe she didn't even speak to him. She spoke, her brother spoke on her behalf. So how are you a chassid? So basically what this meant was, and Sarah Schneer actually, I would say, her nickname was Chassidista. Really she was a Rebbe, but you're not allowed to say that. But she was a Rebbe. I mean, Rebbes stood up when she walked into the room. There's no doubt, without anyone saying it, she was a Rebbe. There were Rebbe tales told about her. So how do you do Hasidism if you're outside the system? Basically, Beis Yaakov reinvented Hasidism for girls. They found their own pilgrimage. So this here, lots of nature walks. Sarah Schneer herself would take people on 10-hour nature hikes where they would start at midnight and they'd end up on top of a mountain at dawn and they would say Shacharis. Actually, probably not 10 hours, more like 5 hours, right? And they'd stop in the middle and they'd light a bonfire. She basically was, she was Hasidic in the sense of, she was neo-Hasidic, maybe you could say. She was reimagining the origins, the natural origins. Though even in the interwar period, hikes in nature, walks in nature by Hasidic Rebbes were not, you know, unknown, though typically at spas. And Sarah Schneer herself went to spas. But in many other ways, Beis Yaakov was a Hasidic movement. Very infused with the passion and also very, you know, with the social structure of a venerated leader who was Sarah Schneer. And, you know, during these hikes, the fire would be built and the girls would dance around Sarah Schneer. Without the word, obviously it's not kosher to use that language about her, but without that language being used, it's very clear that those practices were adopted. And if you want to know more, I can tell you a lot more. There was a book of, basically you could call it Shivchei Sarah Schneer. It's called Die Mamas Tzava'a. It came out after her death by Gershon Friedenson, the editor of the Beis Yaakov Journal and Beis Yaakov Press and the Poale Agudas Yisrael and all that. He wrote basically what could be considered a collection of Hasidic tales about Sarah Schneer. So anyway, here we are in the present day. And maybe I'll just say a couple more things before we turn to Chaya. So I also collect, so basically I told you we're trying to find every Beis Yaakov that ever existed. There's the one in Toronto. Chaya can tell you which one, right? There's my alma mater. I'm trying not to have any kind of anxiety here. Oh, and Renee's, who else went to that Beis Yaakov on the top right? 14th Avenue and 46th Street. Does anyone know what the middle top Beis Yaakov is, what you're looking at? No. Chaya? No, I have a great one from Antwerp. Shanghai. And so this, and you could almost see the architecture. We're actually, at some point, we're going to crowdsource this and we're going to try to find every person in this photo, or as many as we can find. We already know like 5 or 6 faces, names. What?
What year is that in Shanghai?
It's 42 or 43. So it's even more interesting and complicated than that. You all know the story about the Mir Yeshiva and the visas. So the Rosh Hashiva, Shraga Feivel Mendelssohn? No, that he was in New York. Who was the Rosh Hashiva of Mir? Who? Chaim Shmulevitz. Sorry, I got confused. Chaim Shmulevitz tells the boys, so the boys, it's a visa for them, and they could take a woman with them. They could take a family with them. If they get married in the time after they get the visa, before they go, he said, I want to see every one of you finding a Beis Yaakov girl to marry. And the boys were like, I don't know where we're going. I don't know who I want to marry. The boys were not that into it. And the Beis Yaakov girls found out about this, and the Beis Yaakov girls basically hunted down these boys. And one of them, and they would go to weddings, and they would say, are you one of them, under the guise of selling the Beis Yaakov journal? And they would say, I have a proposition to make. And there were quite a few women who saved their own lives this way. And Naftali Cohn, who's a professor at Concordia in Montreal, his grandmother, who had a fictitious visa that she got by selling the Beis Yaakov journal to some boy at a wedding, she married him fictitiously, and then she married him really. And he's we have her on tape describing this story. And Glenn Diner is writing an article, or maybe has already published an article about this episode of the girls who tried to save themselves by finding a boy. So so there's girls in that crowd who snagged themselves. Talk about a shidduch crisis, right? Anyone know what this one is?
The one in the middle?
Yeah. Under Shanghai. Oh, come on, you Canadians. Montreal. There's Brooklyn. There's the logo of the teacher seminary in Argentina, brought back by my student who's now in Argentina again. Here's my Beis Yaakov project. I don't have time, and I'm also couldn't figure out how to get on the internet. This is what you'll see. You'll see as many photographs as I can find. If you have family photographs, are willing to digitize them and share them. Just a good scan is fine, or even a very good high-res photo. We have photos. You click on every photo, and you find out as much information as you can. There's our Beis Yaakov swag, the Uriel Birnbaum. David Birnbaum is definitely going to get one as the closest living relative of the of the artist. I think I'm just... Oh, yeah, I can't play this either, I think, without the internet, can I? It doesn't matter. This is a videotape of girls. So we're now, one of the projects that we want to do, we're also making a film, and what we want to document, among other things, is the pilgrimage to, because why not, right? Is the pilgrimage to Sarah Schneer's grave almost any day of the year, and often any midnight of the year, you will find Beis Yaakov girls singing and dancing around Sarah Schneer's reconstructed grave, reconstructed by Neshea Agudas Yisrael in 2005, I think. There's the 80th yard site. The 90th yard site is coming up in 2 years. This is just one of the mass gatherings around the world. This one is at the Barclay Center in Brooklyn. The 50th one was in Madison Square Garden. So let me just say that the world does not even know that Orthodox women exist. They think that an Orthodox Jew is someone with a black hat. How they imagine these Orthodox Jews propagate, I don't know, something to do with the hat, maybe. And they also do not realize that these women have their own culture there, our own culture, organizations, school systems that are not carbon copies or patriarchal, narrow, small, insular variations of the yeshivas. They're their own thing. Women have their own pilgrimage festivals, their own pilgrimage practices. They have their own mass gatherings in the tens of thousands to venerate a woman who died in 1935, who's remembered, who's in the heart of every Beis Yaakov girl who ever lived. And we're all sisters, right? Because we have one mother. And this is something that the world does not know, and for whatever reason, the Canadian government wants to help me get the word out. So here's Sorry, why is this not advancing? So just to give you some shots of, I spent the summer filming with Pearl Gluck, Bais Yaakov of Borough Park. Everybody involved in this project, not everybody, but almost everybody went to Bais Yaakov. So Pearl Gluck is a filmmaker professor at Penn State. There she is with my mother, who turned 100 that summer. Kanai Nahara, she just got over COVID for the second time. She should be in the Guinness Book of World Records. And there we are interviewing my mother about Bais Yaakov Chernovitz. And there is the seminary building, and there we interviewed Joanna Lizek, who was supposed to be at the conference, but she got COVID. It's still out there. And, oh my God, what's his name? Dario Steckert. Is Dario Steckert, who's the one who discovered the these are two Polish Catholics who are, you know, devote their lives to Jewish history. Dariusz is the one who, he's the one who, quote unquote, discovered Sara Schneer's Lost Diary, which is about to be published. Joanna is going to present on it, but now it's going to be on Zoom. And there's the seminary building, and there is Frank London. Does anyone know who Frank London is? Frank London of the Klezmatics, probably the world's best klezmer, musician, clarinetist, playing his clarinet, playing the Bais Yaakov lead on his clarinet in the seminary building stairwell. We have that on film. And here's me in Israel with the Machna Yehuda graffiti of Sara Schneer. Do you know about that? So Machna, you know Machna Yehuda the Shuk? So in Machna Yehuda, there's a graffiti artist who did all these Jewish faces on the gates when they closed the stores. And Sara Schneer's face got, we were going to film there or do something, and we got there, and her face was defaced. Somebody had covered it over with black spray paint. I have no idea why, like maybe it's a woman, who knows. So we actually found the graffiti artist, and you're not allowed to pay someone to be in your documentary film, so we just paid for his spray paint and got him to do it again, and we have that on tape. And I guess, what else? Oh, yes, Rabka. Here's Rabka, the famous resort town where Sara Schneer, where the girls spent, until they had the seminary building, they spent 3 months there every summer getting trained, and then they would immediately be sent off to their first position, and do not pass go, which means do not go home because your parents will try to get you involved in shidduchim, and they didn't want that because they were desperate for teachers. Here's another photo from Rabka. And in the Birnbaum archive, there's, I think, four or five other photos of Rabka, of the Birnbaums, Shlomo Birnbaum and his wife, Irina, visiting Rabka. We didn't have an address. We just had a bunch of photos. We got in a car, drove to Rabka. We're walking around town holding the photo, and we're standing in front of that house, and the guy comes out of his front door, and he says, "Can I help you?" And we said, "Is this your house?" And he said, "Yes, obviously it's my house." And he said, "What do you, you know? What do you, why are you filming?" And we said, "Well, we're right doing a documentary about this girls' school system." And he's like, "Oh yeah, my grandfather told me about the girls that would come every summer." And we said, "Can we go inside?" And he said, "Yes, but it's kind of, we haven't remodeled in 80 years." And we're like, "Perfect, perfect." So this is me from actually the view from the porch, what that looks like. That's Rabka. And here, the Birnbaums and Bais Yaakov, I'm not going to get into that because Kalman's going to tell you a lot more about the Birnbaum archive. So maybe that's enough for now, except I think I'll turn this. Oh, yeah, on the website, lots of walking tours, so if you're in Williamsburg and you want to know where all the Bais Yaakovs are, where was the first Bais Yaakov in Williamsburg? We have a walking tour of Williamsburg. If you're in Krakow, you know where the seminary building is, you know where Sara Schneer's grave is. What else is there of Bais Yaakov interest? We'll tell you 10 other things of Bais Yaakov interest. And we're going to have one of Toronto. So that's, I think, my segue.
you so much for having me here. I will be brief, especially because I'm suffering a little bit from the curse of the second speaker, which is that Professor Seidman has masterfully hit most of the things I was going to say, which is why I'm her student. It's great. And I'm going to try and, thank you, just bring what Professor Seidman, I am, yes. Okay, thank you. I'm going to tell you in a moment. I want to take what Naomi said and sort of take it to Toronto specifically and into the present day. I am a student of BASAC, a graduate of BASAC of Toronto, which I'm going to just tell you a brief history of. Like Professor Seidman said, I feel a little bit, I'm sure there are a lot of people in this room who know a lot more about Toronto Jewish history than I do, but very briefly, in the early 1900s, Jewish community was in Toronto was concentrated in the Ward neighborhood, which is incidentally just south of where I go to school with Naomi at U of T now. This is the Elm Street Synagogue, which where Eitz Chaim started at, called at the time the Polisher Talmud Torah. It was an afternoon school at the time. It opened in 1915, and it grew very, very quickly. And in 1926, they opened a parallel girls' school class. Again, still in the, only in the afternoon. It grew very quickly again, and then, of course, after the Holocaust, there was a big influx of religious people who valued, who wanted to have a school for their children. It was steadily growing, and eventually, there was a school for, an afternoon school opened for high school boys, and eventually a Beis Yaakov of Toronto was opened as an extension of Eitz Chaim. It was in there was a school at that point on Viewmount, as I'm sure many of you knew, and it opened in the house next door there was a grade 9 on and off for a while, and then there started being a grade 10 class of that was the beginning of Beis Yaakov in Toronto. It eventually, I had a photo for this. This is when they moved in. I just found this photo and I liked it. This is when they moved to Viewmount. I don't know if you can read it, but in 1956, Eitz Chaim Schools established at Viewmount. That's still the elementary school. But, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. 1960 or 1963, there's some differing dates for when Beis Yaakov High School of Toronto opened. I apologize. What is interesting about, what is, I think, useful about Toronto as an example is that it follows a lot of established patterns that we see with other out-of-town Beis Yaakovs, which is that you start with this community school that's sort of grassroots and open to everyone, and then as the community grows, you could sort of say that the community school is a victim of its own success, in that the community is bigger and parents are able to be like pickier, and so Toronto follows this pattern of having the initial school growing and growing and growing, and then opening up other schools competing because the community is now able to uphold multiple schools. Naomi and I, well, not really I, but on the Beis Yaakov project, we have Dr. Leslie Ginsbar Klein, who does a lot of the research on sort of like contemporary trends in Beis Yaakov, and she's written about this. She's going to be at the conference as well. And she's written about how this is a very common pattern in out-of-town communities, that you start with this community school, and then it they grow and you open these parallel schools. So this is Tiferes Beis Yaakov and Benos Beis Yaakov. Benos Beis Yaakov opened in 1999 to be like a more like conservative or right-wing option, and then Tiferes in 2000 to be a more left-wing option, and there are sort of like, you know, communal shades of difference between those, and that's, again, like a very typical pattern for how Beis Yaakov's communities evolve and develop. So that's, I think, one of the things that we're doing, and I'm doing with Naomi, is we're, again, studying these trends, studying these contemporary, what happens, you know, we have that whole story, and then, you know, where does that go after that? This is me. There's a lot to say. first fun little plug, this is me in a bass yakko play. This was when I was in seminary, not in high school. That's me there, and in the role of the ringleader of the Haskalah, bringing the threat of secular education to the Jewish community. So make of that what you will. That's just a fun fact. But I want to talk about the bass yakko play, which again, like Professor Seidman said, starts in the very early years of Bais Yaakov. And to me, the Bais Yaakov play is a really good example of what I think is the sort of three components of what Bais Yaakov is right now. So obviously, it's a school system, and it's about education. And the way that that manifests in the plays is that you might be able to surmise. So this is, many, many Bais Yaakov plays have historical themes. In fact, I think that marrying someone so that you can get to Shanghai has been the subject of tens of Bais Yaakov plays, I'm sure. Often historical, always some sort of like educational message and theme and sort of religious lesson to it, I would say. And so that's one important component of the Bais Yaakov play. But more, and also obviously of Bais Yaakov, which of course, is a school, and like the high school I went to was very much prided itself on specifically its halacha education as being like exceptional among Bais Yaakovs, and yeah, so definitely education is a huge part of a school, you would think, but I think that when you think of Bais Yaakov as simply a school system, you're really missing out on a huge part of the story, which is what I titled this talk, which is education, community, and culture. So the Bais Yaakov play is, I would say, first and foremost, supposed to be an educational experience for the students in the school. And they are, they are learning about, hopefully, about the subject matter that the play is about. And they're also, and this is important and part of the culture part, is that Bais Yaakov plays are one of many instances of, like Naomi said, performance culture and, yeah, I think performance culture, et cetera, I would say, that Bais Yaakovs have, like, you'll have a choir on Bais Yaakov, on Rosh Chodesh. You'll have, at least in my school, I'm drawing mainly from my own experience, but I think this is pretty universal, that their grade 12 will have all these different committees, and each one will have a theme song, and everyone in the school learns the theme song, and that's part of the cultural experience. This is not original to me at all. Other people have spoken about this, the fact that Bais Yaakov girls have a lot of opportunities to develop leadership skills and creativity and things like that, that, as Naomi mentioned, like, within the from community, people will say, like, it's such a shame that boys don't get these opportunities, and that girls have, that girls do have these opportunities to lead, to take initiative, to run huge things. I'm not even going to get to the convention, which is, like, a gigantic undertaking. So the Bais Yaakov play produces this internal culture of these songs that get passed on, and this cultural experience, which also goes back to Sarah Schneerer, who had, you know, in the earliest days of Bais Yaakov, there would be, you know, singing on Shabbos afternoons and things like that. This is something that's been present as more than just education from the very beginning of Bais Yaakov and is still present. And lastly, and this is like an interesting tension, that the Bais Yaakov play is, again, I would say, this is like a bit of a tension, but primarily about the experience of producing it. But at the end of the day, you produce something for the community. And Bais Yaakov, again, it's education and it's culture for teenage girls. I'm ignoring elementary school at the moment. But it's also very much a player within its community. And that appears in a bunch of different ways. And one of them is that people who often will not be going to, you know, generally produce theater get an opportunity to an evening out, women only, of course, to see some amateur theater and have a good time. But that's just one instance of the much broader way that, yeah, again, Bais Yaakov is a player within its community. So right now it's like almost Pesach time. When I was in high school, it was a volunteer thing, but if you were willing and able, you could sign up to be sent to different people in the community who might need some help Pesach cleaning. And Sunday morning, you'd spend a couple hours helping someone out. And even when it wasn't Pesach time, there were constant like chesed opportunities and initiatives that were expected of the students, that we were expected to be players within our community. More, there were like, they, our school used to talk about how before there was a government requirement for community service hours, Base Yakov was doing that. And you had to have 40 hours throughout high school. I think like most of us had about 60 hours each year. And because Base Yakov very much sees itself as not just a closed off specific educational thing for its own students, but very, very much a player within its community. So I, again, there's all these different things. Rabbi Stefanski, the second and most formative principal of Beis Yaakov in Toronto, had a pet project, which was called Ashrinu, which was to teach Hebrew to the new wave of Soviet or post-Soviet Jewish immigrants, and also just general like Jewish education, which I taught a girl Hebrew when I was in grade 9, which again is part of this whole picture of Beis Yaakov as part of its own community and as a really important resource for its own community and an important player in forming its communal life and communal culture. So to me, the Beis Yaakov play is a really good example of the way that, yeah, we've got education, you have, and I, you can't really see, but like we had painted the backdrops, like it's a big project, like Naomi mentioned, education of its own students, cultural production of its own students, and being a player within and a contributor toward the broader community that it's a part of. And yeah, so to me, the Beis Yaakov play is a really good example of that, and that's what I've been researching with Naomi and interviewing people working on Beis Yaakov plays. That's our big new project, as Professor Zadman mentioned. And so, yeah, thank you for your time.
USB, would it be just maybe?
Yeah, let me get the USB. Let me find that. This is a good opportunity to use the washroom for those of you who need it. David? I think you have my USB. I don't think you gave it back to me.
Oh, I remember.
You gave it back to me?
Yeah.
David, could you come help me just so I...
Yeah,
here we go. I don't want to risk anything, so that's why I'm asking
you
your help.
It. You got it. You
Where
got
is it,
it?
Right here?
Yeah, you got it.
I use Mac, so...
Yeah, me too. So it's already recognizing there. You just, yeah. Yeah, you got it. Yep.
Yeah, to take a break. Should we start or should we give it a couple minutes for people who left for the washroom?
Let's start with
1 minute? Okay. Thank you.
So
yes, it's very nice to meet you, and thank you.
Yeah.
That was great.
Thanks. Yeah. And I really enjoyed what you were saying on Thursday. I don't know how much of it.
There'll be a lot of repetition. Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of names, so I think we're going to have some.
Yeah.
But,
start? Okay, friends, we're going to get started. Okay, time is marching along, so I'm going to get started. Amos? Okay, we'll just wait for David to take a seat. So it's a pleasure to be here this morning. It's not very often that I get to talk about, well, rather to be in the presence of people I'm talking about or their close family. Usually I talk about people who, you know, lived in the 19th century. So this is a real pleasure. It's also quite intimidating because I'm standing right in front of my heroes. So, all right, let me start my clock because, like Naomi said, professors of Jewish history tend to talk. And I gotta be mindful of the time. Naomi's always wonderful to speak after her because Naomi brings to you an authentic New York accent. I also have a New York accent, and you can compare notes, but Naomi and I are from the same place, but we have two very different trajectories. I was born in Borough Park, Brooklyn, but I grew up in Staten Island, worlds apart. Okay. When I came to Toronto about 20 years ago, I'm gonna start with a little bit of a personal story, it was very difficult, my adjustment, for many idiosyncratic reasons. But one of the high points of this was the presence of the Birnbaum Family Collection, the archives here in Toronto, which is, I'm going to make clear for you a case, one of the most important archives for understanding the modern Jewish experience. I was always working in YIVO, the Jewish Scientific Institute in New York, which is mainly about secular topics, although there's largely Orthodox and rabbinic collections there also, but YIVO was founded in Vilna in 1925 to pursue a mission, a Jewish nationalist mission of collecting data about Jews to build a modern, secular, Yiddish-speaking culture. Now, one of the reasons why the Birnbaum archives is so important is precisely because it tells you parts of the other side of the story. It's very comprehensive, but it tells us so much about the much-neglected world of Orthodoxy. And in part, it's not only about the history of Orthodoxy, but it's also figures who were significant in secular movements like Yiddishism, like the birth of Zionism, but have been largely disregarded or for a long time neglected by modern Jewish historiography, precisely because they were Orthodox. And Orthodoxy for a long time got short shrift in mainstream Jewish historiography. Thankfully, that's begun to change in recent decades. So this is an amazing story I'm going to tell you about three generations of this spectacular family. I'm not going to hide my admiration, okay? There's no point. So let me tell you, first of all, who these people are, our main players. Standing is Solomon Birnbaum, the first professor of Yiddish in a modern European university, the man who dated the Dead Sea Scrolls before radiocarbon dating was applied. Also, the major figure in Yiddish scholarship, aside from Max Weinreich, who was the head of YIVO. When I was in graduate school, I first encountered Solomon Birnbaum. His ideas were a radical challenge to the mainstream of secular Yiddish scholarship. I won't go too deep into that now, but this is a major figure who settled here in Toronto. His papers are sitting in a basement of a home in North York, Toronto. Scholars from throughout the world come to visit. David's here, who's curated this collection for the last 30 years, right? It's in the basement of his house. He's done a mammoth job of annotating, indicating, providing information to scholars visiting. My first encounter with David was, well, just to give you more history, I discovered the Birnbaums when I was first read a biography of Nathan Birnbaum, who's sitting on the right, learned about his fantastic transformations of Judaism, and I'll tell you about that in a minute. Then I discovered his son Solomon, who was a Yiddish scholar, a scholar of Jewish languages. I wrote an article. I sent it to David. David not only corrected the facts that were wrong, that only he would know, he also corrected my English grammar. I think his brother Eli Luza Birnbaum also had a hand in this. And this is not the kind of treatment that a scholar usually gets when he visits an archive. I'd merely sent a letter to Toronto, and I got this tremendous feedback. Sitting, of course, is Yankov Birnbaum, Jacob Birnbaum, the founder of the movement to liberate Soviet Jewry in the 1960s, this grassroots movement that I'll tell you about in a minute. The exodus of about 1.5 million Jews from the Soviet Union really traces its origins to the activity of this young man, or then young man. And there are other people in the story that you'll soon encounter. So let me begin with Nathan. Nathan was born in the second half of the 20th century in Vienna to parents from Galicia, traditional Jews. But Nathan made his way away from Orthodox Judaism as a young man. This was the currents of the time. Young Jews were attracted to materialism, secular philosophy, things of this nature. But he went a different way. Even though he was no longer Orthodox by the time he had reached university, probably after his father's death when he was a boy, he probably began to move in a different direction. He maintained an extremely strong Jewish consciousness. At a time when most Jews in Vienna considered themselves part of the German nation, Jews by religion, part of the German nation, he found this idea ridiculous. He insisted that Jews were a distinct people. He founded a student youth group called Kadima, which was the first major Jewish youth group in a modern University of Vienna. He's really the leader of Zionism before Theodor Herzl. He creates this journal called Selbstemanzipation. You see it on the left, in the early 1880s. This is where the term Zionism is coined, right? It's one of these ironies of history that historiography of the Zionist movement has forgotten the man who created the term Zionism itself. That's begun to change, but for a very long time, he was written out of this history. What did he want at the time? He wanted settlement, agricultural settlement of Jews in the land of Israel. He wanted the revival of the Hebrew language. He wanted Jews to be proud Jews and not to consider themselves some part of another group because, frankly, he thought it was ridiculous. No one else thought Jews were Germans except for Jews. He later grew sour on the idea of Zionism, however. He thought it was spiritually barren. Theodor Herzl came on the scene. He created political Zionism. It lacked a cultural dimension. Through his political activity, particularly in Galicia, the province of the Austro-Hungarian Empire where his parents had come from, he encountered Eastern European Jews, and it took some time, but from being someone who looked down upon Yiddish as this mongrel deformation of German, Jews should learn Hebrew, they should get away from Yiddish, he became a champion of Yiddish and Eastern European Jewry, so much so that over time he became a champion of the cause that we call diaspora nationalism. And this is really the second phase that we associate with him, the movement for recognition of Jews as a national community in multi-ethnic empires of Eastern Europe. In his case, this was the Austro-Hungarian Empire. In 1908, he organizes the famous first Yiddish language conference, which is held in Czernowitz, which is a city you've heard a lot about today, very famous city in Jewish history. This is the picture you see in the bottom right. Here he is with his wife sitting to his right, with various other figures who were at the conference, not all of them. You can see Yudlamit Peretz on the right, Chaim Zhitlovsky. I could go on and on. Of course, all of these are secular figures. By this time, however, Nathan Birnbaum had begun his path of return, in quotation marks. He'd grown up Orthodox. He had begun to return to traditional practice. And this is something that unfolded over the next decade. It didn't all happen at once, and it's a complicated process. He's written books about it, and I highly recommend. I mean, this is what Nathan Birnbaum was mainly remembered today. He's the famous Baal Tshuva, whose books like From an Apikoros to a Believer are still read, right? This is an amazing story in itself. There are various versions of the story. One version is that he went to New York in 1907 as he's crossing the Atlantic. He had an experience with the Shechina. He encounters the divine presence over the waters of the Atlantic. And there are other versions too, but it's a gradual process that leads to his return to full observance. His sons follow with him. The family becomes Frum. This is Nathan Birnbaum not long after. By around the early 1920s, he is the general secretary of Agudas Yisrael, which was founded formally in 1912. It becomes more prominent after World War I. Naomi's spoken a bit about this, so I won't go into great detail, but imagine this man who was only a decade earlier at the head of the secular Yiddishist diaspora nationalist movement is now one of the heads of the movement of organized Orthodox Jewry in Eastern Europe. Right? This is an amazing story in itself. Later on in his life, He also grew somewhat distanced from this. He found that there were problems with orthodoxy too. He continued to be an Orthodox Jew, but he found that the leadership of the Aguda, he felt it was spending too much time not focused enough on the everyday needs of Jews, both spiritual and material. He, throughout his, the ends of his years of his life, he launched a movement called the Olim, Olim, or Aulim, as they say in the German pronunciation of Hebrew, for an elite of Jews to settle and create agricultural communities in the land of Israel. And this is really, in some ways, a return to his early thought of the late 19th century, but now with a spiritual side to it. Now, I'm going to take you to the next generation. Oh, this is just a photo of his trip. Thank you. Naomi gave me this photo from David's archives of Nathan Birnbaum on his trip to the United States in 1921. He made several trips to the United States, several, a few trips to the United States in his lifetime. And by the way, this was, I should say, emphasize, this was shocking to his peers in the Zionist movement and other movements. He continued to be an influential thinker. People continued to read him. He was a very important critic of other movements. But people didn't know, at a time when everybody, large numbers of Jews were moving away from tradition, it was shocking to see someone move back to tradition. In a sense, he's one of the pioneering Balei Tshuva of the 20th century. Okay. Here we get to Shlomo Birnbaum, Solomon Birnbaum. By the way, you know, you might find it remarkable in itself, and I've written a book that's largely a biography of Solomon Birnbaum, and I have a chapter which starts with his name. What's special about his name? Because his name was Salomo Birnbaum, Salomo Asher Birnbaum, right? This is how he's registered in the Kehillah of Vienna in the early 20th century. Who names his children Salomo in the early 20th century, the late 19th century, I should say? The leadership of the Kehillah in Vienna greatly encouraged his parents to choose a different name, like Zygmunt, right? All the sons had traditional names. It wasn't quite illegal, but the Kehillah of Vienna very much encouraged the parents to choose non-traditional names. In fact, I found an article saying all these Jewish boys come from Galicia to Vienna. It was a trend in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. To make a living, you leave from the provinces, you come to Vienna. Things are better there. But they can't get by because they're burdened by these Yiddish and Hebrew names. They all need to change their names when they come. And here he was going against the current of the time. Okay, so on the left is you have Solomon Birnbaum's 1918 Yiddish grammar. This is the first major modern scientific grammar of Yiddish. He actually wrote it when he was 23. He started writing it. He really wrote it when he was in 1915, but World War I came in the way. He volunteered to serve. He was actually editing the proofs in the trenches. He was shot in the neck on the front in Italy, spent a lot of time in the hospital recovering, where he started to work on what eventually became his doctoral dissertation, even before he started graduate school. In fact, it's important to note that he wrote this book without access to a library, without formal linguistics training. He'd only had a little bit of tutoring in the subject. So this is an amazing autodidact. In fact, many of these people in this story I'm going to tell you are autodidacts. It's a brilliant family. There's just no two ways other than to describe it. This book opens the doors to his getting a position to teach Yiddish at the University of Hamburg in 1922. It opens the doors to generations of scholars of German, or German scholars, just to say, scholars who read German, to encounter Yiddish, to begin to take it seriously. In fact, the reason why we call the word Yiddish in scientific literature by the 1920s and 30s is because Solomon Birnbaum called it Yiddish and not Jargon or Judendeutsch or some other word. I'm not talking about how Jews called it. That's a different story. I'm talking about scholarly literature called it by other names, Judeo-German and so on. He said this is the language of Jews. It deserves respect as such. It's like any other language. Therefore, we're going to call it Yiddish, which is what it's called by its speakers. And from Yiddish in German, we get Yiddish, of course, in English academic usage. Here he is with his family in Hamburg in 1932. His wife Irene Rickel. It's hard to imagine. This is Luzel Birnbaum. This is Eli Birnbaum as a young boy. This is Chava, his sister, his older sister. And this is Yankif on the right. And that's, of course, Solomon Birnbaum. This is Beis Yaakov. I'm not going to say much about Beis Yaakov because you've heard a lot. But I will say that Birnbaum was the language expert for Beis Yaakov. He introduced the orthodox system of spelling, which was based on pre-Haskalah writing in Yiddish, with scientific tweaks, which is, in my opinion, the best spelling system in Yiddish that exists to this day, but has fallen out of use, except for a few people. All right, if you have any questions about that, I'll tell you about that privately, because most people think spelling isn't interesting. I think spelling is fascinating. Okay, unfortunately, he had to leave Germany in 1933. I mean, he was lucky, I shouldn't say unfortunately. He was prescient. I found a letter from him. He was involved in this project, and it's a whole other story, to create a chair for Yiddish in Weimar, Germany. The people who were working with him to create the chair ended up becoming Nazis. And that's a whole other story. But he understood by 1933, he wrote to his father that I expect in a decade there'll be almost no Jews left in Germany. He didn't understand what was going to happen, but he knew it was only going to get much, much worse. He himself was roughed up in the postal office in Hamburg. His son Yankov was very little, was roughed up by other boys. They shoved dirt into his mouth. In secret, he met with his brother and father, and I'll tell you the brothers in a minute. They left Germany. They made plans to leave Germany, and they all met in Holland, where most of the family lived after 33. He made his way to London. His wife was born in Vienna, but had grown up in London, so it facilitated the process of going to London. He became, and this is itself a remarkable story, and I mean, David has told me the story, it's been written about, but it's still hard to believe. This important professor, linguist, Jobson, knocked on the door of his house in London. Imagine this is a family, they're refugees, they've got nothing. Knocks on the door, holding up that little grammar book, and says, "Are you Professor Birnbaum who wrote this book?" Began a lifetime friendship. Jobson, along with the Jewish community of London, helped to create positions for him eventually, two positions, lectureships. One in Hebrew paleography and epigraphy, that is the study of old Hebrew writing through the generations. And the other is Yiddish. So he became, at University of College in London, the expert in Yiddish and Hebrew, Hebrew writing in Yiddish. Let me just say a word about the paleography, because it may not be obvious to people. Paleography means old writing. He developed the system of dating texts based on the shape of Hebrew letters. How did this happen? When he was a young man in the 1920s, he was studying Yiddish Bible translations. And he noticed that all these books, these manuscripts, I should say, that the great founders of Wissenschaft des Judentums, that is, the scholarship of Judaism, which was began in 19th century Germany, they were getting the dates wrong. All the collections in European libraries had lots of errors. So he wanted to get a job correcting the errors. No one was going to hire him for this kind of thing. But he developed the system of dating texts based on handwriting. He wrote a doctoral dissertation, or I should call it, it's called Habilitation. In Germany and much of Europe, you have to write a second dissertation to become a full professor. And he was a lowly lector. So his Habilitation dissertation, he wrote two of them, in fact, one on Hebrew poetry, one on Hebrew scripts, showing how you could date these things. They were both rejected. The reasons were probably because, first of all, his scholarship was too avant-garde. It was too pioneering for his times, and his colleagues, he thought his colleagues were jealous. It's quite possible that there were anti-Semitic motives also, particularly in the second case, the paleography document, dissertation. At least one of the scholars was a member of the Nazi Party. All right, so it's he understood very well what he was dealing with in those times. This is the reprint that David, Elie Birnbaum, and Jean Baumgarten in Paris, that we reissued in 2016 of Salomon Birnbaum's, one of his great works, which is Yiddish, a Survey and a Grammar, which is really everything he's done about Yiddish in one book. When I say everything, it's a gross exaggeration. Some of his major hits about Yiddish that changed the field of study of Yiddish over his lifetime. Fortunately, he had a very long life. He lived to be almost 100. This is an excerpt from, well, these, of course, this is, I think this is Habakkuk. These are documents, these are materials he used in producing his book, his other major work, which is the Hebrew scripts, the study of Hebrew writing for thousands of years, right? And what you can see is his own writing, his own reproductions of various writings that are used in these books. By the way, he studied architecture for a few years. Everyone in this family has this amazing artistic sense. You can see how well they draw. Here he is, or rather, here he is with his brother Menachem. So let me tell you a little bit about Menachem. This photo was taken in Hamburg in the early 1920s. Max Weinreich, the famous scholar of Yiddish, one of the founders of YIVO, led YIVO in New York until his death in 1969. Max Weinreich was so impressed with Salomon Birnbaum, he invited him to join YIVO. But Salomon Birnbaum refused. He didn't want to be part of a Jewish organization that was founded on secularist principles. He was willing to work with YIVO scholars to print in their journals, but he didn't want to be a member of the philological section of YIVO. Max Weinreich lived with Menachem Birnbaum, his brother, in Berlin when Max Weinreich was a student. Naturally, he expected that Salomon Birnbaum would be eager to join him in his activities. Here he is, traveled with Menachem to Hamburg. He took his wife, that's Regina Weinreich on the right. That is Tina Birnbaum, Menachem's wife, on the left. They all sat together in this famous restaurant in Hamburg, Jacob's Restaurant. Who's taking the photo? Max Weinreich. Max Weinreich esteemed the Birnbaum so much that he stood outside the photo and took the photo of them. Right? That's how much Yiddish scholarship admired him, even though that's largely been forgotten. Menachem Birnbaum is the second son. Menachem was an illustrator and artist of great talent. I chose this photo because it shows his light side. This is one of his, postcards, showing, the Jew burning the midnight oil. By day, he's writing exchange bills. By night, he's playing cards, right? These humorous postcards that he made. This is some of his more, you might say, serious art. This is his portrait of the Rambam. This is from his book, Chad Gadya. This is the angel of death, slaughter is the cattle slaughter. We recently did this exhibit at the University of Toronto. We're hoping the University of Toronto will become the permanent home of the Birnbaum collection. This is one of these amazing books. You have to take a look at his artwork. This is stuff that art collectors in Europe, art galleries in Europe, art archives, have many copies. Some of it's here in Toronto, but there's a lot of his stuff in Europe, and of course some of it's been published. Fantastic artist. Unfortunately, Menachem was also murdered by the Germans. He and his family, his wife, his two children, probably killed in Auschwitz. That's the last they were seen. Uriel fortunately survived. This is the youngest son. Uriel was not only an artist, but also a poet, a writer. Here he is, his book, In God's War. Uriel wrote a lot about war. He was also a frontline soldier who was injured during World War I. He was a Habsburg champion. He believed the Habsburg Empire was a good thing. Of course, the Habsburg Empire fell apart after World War I. Because the Habsburg Empire was beloved by Jews, because Jews were treated as equals. Jews were one national group amongst many. And he felt this was precisely the kind of thing we need to prevent people from becoming savages who kill each other in the name of nationalism. This is one of his children's books, but he's mainly known for his other artwork on Jewish themes. By the way, I neglected to mention that Menachem was the in-house art director of two important Jewish publishing houses in Berlin, the Weltverlag and Ostverlag, all right? So very important Jewish publishing houses. Menachem is celebrated to this day. I mean, Menachem, but also Uriel. I'm sorry, I'm getting the names confused with so many Birnbaums, but you know whom I'm talking about. These are some other works by Uriel. You see he worked a lot on Jewish themes. Both of them worked on non-Jewish themes too because they earned their livings by doing artwork. So there's also commercial stuff they did like calendars, but tremendously creative people. And I believe, and David could correct, tell me where it is precisely, there are actually stained glass windows with this artwork here in Toronto. Now this is Yankiv Jacob. Jacob is perhaps best known to people in this room. Jacob was very much influenced by the experience of his family, the experience of World War II. As a young man, or as a young boy, I should say, in London, Jacob remembered his father coming home at night crying. Why was his father crying during World War II beyond the obvious reasons? His father was employed by the British Censorship Office. which meant it was his job to read all the letters that were coming across the British Empire from Jews and non-Jews. He was assigned the Jewish letters, which meant he read the letters in Yiddish, he read the letters in Ladino, he read the letters in Judeo-Arabic if he could, he read the letters in other Jewish languages. He became very familiar with all sorts of Jewish languages, and this is how he became the founder of the field of modern Jewish interlinguistics, the study of Jewish languages and their relationship to each other, all right, by working on these letters during World War II. He knew, Solomon, what was going on in occupied territory. He wasn't allowed to talk about it, it was confidential. In fact, the British used some of this information for military purposes. They use it to bomb German installations. People would write, there's a this going on, there's a that going on, and from that, the British were able to deduce where there was a German factory producing munitions. But Jacob knew from his father what was going on with the lives of Jews. He was inspired to act on their behalf. After World War II, he worked with Holocaust survivors for their relief. He also worked with Jewish boys, disadvantaged boys, in Morocco. He founds in the 1960s, he comes to the United States, he founds the movement on behalf of Soviet Jewry, the Student Struggle for Soviet Jewry, which is a nonviolent movement which was inspired by the civil rights movement of the time. And you're probably familiar with this to some extent, but you know, he's living in New York. He's going up to Yeshiva University, knocking on the doors of students, telling them to come out to mass rallies. The slogan of the movement becomes, "Let my people go." And here you can see him. This is simply one of the mass rallies. This is, you know, this is the Russian, "Let my people go." This went on for some time, of course. Finally, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, Soviet Jewry was finally allowed to leave. Birnbaum's role in this movement is beginning to be written. It's appeared in a few articles, but we're still waiting a comprehensive history of this movement and the pioneering role of Jacob Birnbaum. By the way, there's a street named on Washington Heights up for him, right? This is where he lived much of his life until 2014. Finally, I simply want to bring home the point that this is a Toronto family. David, who's here, moved with his parents because his brother, Eli, was here. His other brother was by then in New York. One family member, Chava, yes, I'll say that in a second. One family member, Chava, is still living in England. The family settled here. Eli became a professor of Turkology, the study of Turkish languages, at the University of Toronto, which now has his papers. People tell me over and over again when I mention that I write about Solomon Birnbaum, I used to run into him and the stacks at Robarts Library. He was hard of hearing, but we had conversations. This is what they always tell me. I think of Solomon Birnbaum as a tall man because everyone describes him in memoirs as a tall man. And then you see, and everyone that you meet here in Toronto says, I remember him as a small, older gentleman. Okay, this is happens as we age. Here is the family. This is Sarah, who's with us today. This is her wedding. What year is this? 1983. Okay, I don't read my own notes. I get very excited. This is a family that struck deep roots here in Toronto, multiple generations. This family spread out elsewhere. But this is a family that's made major contributions to Jewish history and to Toronto Jewish history. Several of Solomon Birnbaum's books, or several, his major book, I should say, was published twice by the University of Toronto Press. Once by him, once by me. So I don't know that. That's like vicarious yichus, something like that. That's as much as I'm going to say. I think you get my point. I think this is an amazing gem that more people need to know about, and that it would be a shame if this collection left Toronto. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming.
So first to Dr. Seidman and Chaya, I'm the chairman of the Ontario Jewish Archives. So I don't know whether some of the your findings come from the archives, but if you find things that are not on the archives and the results of your research, we would love to have it in the Ontario Jewish Archives to be available in perpetuity to researchers. So that's a comment.
Yeah, before Chaya started this work, there was someone named Hannah Schachter who was working on it, who I think went to your archive on my behalf. Does that name sound ring a bell?
Doesn't.
Okay, we have to talk.
Yeah, so if there's new things, we'd love to have them.
Okay.
And secondly, to Dr. Weiser, what would it mean to the University of Toronto to have these archives here in the university? I know it's in Toronto, had the privilege of seeing them myself. And what is required to make that happen?
Okay, so, I mean, this is a question for three people, really. Partly for me, partly for Naomi, and partly for David. And some of it will be, I think we'll have a private conversation afterwards. As a scholar who specializes in the culture and language of Eastern European Jewry, the cultures and languages of Eastern European Jewry, I should say that this, one of the rare chairs in Yiddish studies is here at the University of Toronto. There are graduate students who can work with this collection for decades. Scholars who will come. University of Toronto is located on the subway line. David is, I don't want to speak in David's name, but a non-climate-controlled basement in North York is not the future of this collection, right? It needs proper curation and digitization, hopefully one day. The University of Toronto has a Hebrew language curator, a Judaic studies curator. It has staff. It's got graduate students who are eager to work with this. It's an international site that researchers come to. It makes tremendous sense for the University of Toronto to become the home of this collection. What that will take is complicated, and that's what we know. I could talk to you more about that in private with David present. And maybe Naomi would like to say, as someone who's, I'm at York, so let's make that clear. I love this collection. I love this family. I love Toronto. But I'm sort of the short, I don't know what the right idiom is, but I'm the outsider to all of this. I don't have a pony in this race. Is that the phrase? Something like this. I'm just supporting. I'm a booster. So Naomi can speak directly as someone who teaches Yiddish literature, Jewish studies, modern Jewish literature at the University of Toronto, and works directly with these students more about that.
Just really quickly. So first of all, what this archive has. I go to archives and look for material about Beis Yaakov, in case you haven't figured that out. I've gone to YIVO, for instance, and looked through the microfiche of the Beis Yaakov Journal. I spent the summer doing that. I've gone to Israel and looked at the National Library archive of that. Those archives don't have what the Birnbaum archive has in the flesh, right? They're missing issues. There are all kinds of things that this archive has that the best archives in the world don't have, and partly it's a problem of Orthodox history. The National Library of Israel has been archiving, digitizing, newspapers all around the world. The Orthodox newspapers come last. Why the Orthodox newspapers come last, I don't know. And then when you look at the Orthodox world itself and you see what the Aguda archive in Lower Manhattan looked like, I mean, it was not professional, there are people who devote their lives to it, so I don't want to, but they're not David Birnbaum, and there are people who get paid, and they're not David Birnbaum, and he's doing it out of his love. So this is an archive that we don't have. The Orthodox world does not have an archive like this, unfortunately. For whatever reasons. If the archive came to the University of Toronto, you could train a generation, first of all, aside from people using the archive, what does it mean to have a raw archive, to learn how to display it, how to educate people about it, have international conferences about it, to link it up with other archives, to have, for the first time really, a world-class Orthodox archive. I'm very devoted to Orthodox Jewish history, and it's about time. You know, we've been working, when we wrote the article in the foreword, Kalman and I just had an article in the foreword, Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi says, history is the faith of fallen Jews. And I say, okay, the Jews who aren't fallen, they need some history too. Orthodox Jews, and to me, the fact that the Orthodox Jewish community in Toronto doesn't really even quite understand the treasure that it has in its midst. So this is, I mean, obviously it knows the spiritual treasures that it has. By the way, this is, you know, Nathan Berenbaum was always telling Orthodox Jews, you don't know what you have. So it's funny that I just said that same sentence. You don't know what you have. You need an outsider to come in and tell you, I mean, a Baal Tshuva to come in and tell you what Orthodoxy could be. So Orthodox Jewish history is a sadly neglected field. Orthodox Jews have other priorities, understandably. There's a lot of yeshivas, there's a lot of kids, understandably. But this really has to be, so basically the vision is to make the University of Toronto the leading place for the study of Orthodoxy. And I think what that would mean is persuading Orthodox students that it's okay to come, that's not terrible, you're not going to become an apicurus if you come to the University of Toronto, and that you can study something other than dentistry. But that's a whole other story. Sorry to the dentists out there. Chaya, you want to add something?
Anyway, thank you. I just have a question, Dr. Seidman, about two things. I mean, one is I have a familial connection with Beis Yaakov in Poland. So I mean, first question is, how many students pre-war were in Beis Yaakov in Europe? And second question is, how does the organization Beis Yaakov, what allowed somebody to call themselves a Beis Yaakov school? Or even today, what allows them to call themselves a Beis Yaakov school?
I think you don't even know what a good question that is. Or maybe you do know. Maybe you do know. So it's a very good question, partly because this is the thing about, you know, which archives have the most reliable information. And in some ways, the most professional archives of Beis Yaakov are actually in New York, the Joint Distribution Committee, which was part of what was supporting Beis Yaakov. And so the Beis Yaakov is sending the numbers to the JDC, and how reliable those numbers are, some are more reliable than others. In other words, this is fundraising, how much is publicity, how much is... So we don't have perfect numbers. So the other question is, what counts as a Beis Yaakov? That was the other thing. So one thing you should know right now is that there's no central Beis Yaakov office anymore. Anyone can open up a Beis Yaakov anywhere and call it Beis Yaakov, and it's a Beis Yaakov. And theoretically, though, and because there's no central office, there was a central office. It seems to have survived until maybe 1980 or something like that. And it went out of business for various reasons. But during the interwar period, in the Beis Yaakov journal, there were advertisements as, you know, you may not open a Beis Yaakov without being in contact with us. In other words, people were doing it then too, just opening up Beis Yaakovs. And they opened, they closed, some of them were official, whatever. So the numbers are very squishy, but it was at least probably the most reliable numbers that we have are, it's somewhere between 23,000 and 40,000 by 1939. And even if it's 23,000, which it almost certainly is more, it was still the biggest of the Jewish, independent Jewish school systems. I know that was probably more than you wanted.
I looked this morning. I think in 1937, there were close to 40,000 students.
Where did you look?
In the Beis Yaakov schools. I was reading Salomon Birnbaum's letters to Friedenson from Dusside Chevalt in New York. This is the younger, the son, right? And he's correcting an article that he wrote for 1977 for Dusside Chevalt, and he says, the number is this. That's how I know.
We're going to get as close as you can get. We're going to provide all the possible numbers on the website at some point. Okay.
This question might be a little
overdue. Jews don't count, right?
Okay. This question is probably overdue. I mean, I'm probably asking a question out of ignorance. I mean, we keep hearing about the Birnbaum collection of all these letters and all these great archives that could be given to the university. Can you give us some examples? What are in those letters? What makes it so valuable? What's in there?
Where do we begin? How much time do you have?
Well, that's a question for you. And
okay,
I also have a question.
First of all, every letter and every archive, if it's to the Joint Distribution Committee, it's we need money. If it's anybody else, it's sorry, I know I have owed you a letter for a very long time. They all start like that. But mostly what a letter, so the letters are all kinds of things. So there's two letters from Sarah Schneer. One of the letters is, she says to Salman Birenbaum, here's my article. It's probably her famous article called Yiddish and Yiddishkeit, which is the Beis Yaakov Manifesto. And by the way, I don't know if I've ever talked about this with Kalman. Part of what could be called the Beis Yaakov Yiddishism, I know they wouldn't use that word, is that everybody needs to have a Jewish name, which they didn't all have. So it wasn't just Shlomo who had it. But she says, here's my article. So this is the Orthodox Manifesto on behalf of Yiddish by Sarah Schnierer. And she says, and I'm sorry I probably didn't use the correct spelling that you tell everybody to use, because I'm already old and I don't understand these things.
Okay.
I think that's very interesting that Sarah...
He wants to...
I
understand that that's Sarah Schneer's letters in there, but you're talking about a worldwide interest,
yes,
which means not only the orthodoxy, which means there's got to be things in there which have a secular interest also. I'm trying to figure out what exactly is in there from a secular interest.
Yes, Kalman can tell you.
I'll give you a sort of brief survey. I mean, David probably knows this by heart. For anyone interested in Zionism, there's Theodor Herzl and the other major figures of Zionism. For anyone interested in Yiddish, you've got everyone who is a player in the Yiddish world. For anyone interested in the Dead Sea Scrolls, it's all there. You've also got Einstein, a small name, Martin Buber, the philosopher. You've got all the major intellectual, cultural figures of the 20th century, Jewish life, plus plenty of non-Jewish important figures are there as well. David has a list, and we can show you the list, and you'd be amazed, this list goes on for pages, of names that are household names, major figures in pretty much every political, cultural, intellectual, and artistic movement in modern European and Jewish history are present in this collection.
Give us an example of something really interesting.
Look, my interests are rather skewed. So what's really interesting, I'm trying to think of some of the non-Jewish scholars who wrote to him, psychologists and other people, political figures. I mean, it's a little bit hard because I've sort of like mentioned the ones that come off the tip of my tongue. But I mean, I'd be happy to show you a list afterwards if we can go online. Actually, I've got a document on my computer I can show you later, and you'd be amazed by the names on this list.
Just to follow up comments for Dr. Zeidman, I happen to be from Antwerp, okay? So my sister went to Beis Yaakov of Antwerp. And they're actually at the 100 years anniversary of the school, and it's, as an aside, the school there is not called just Beis Yaakov, it's called Yesod HaTorah Beis Yaakov. I went to Yesod HaTorah, so it's considered in one name, actually, Yesod HaTorah Beis Yaakov, which was an arm of the boys' school. And at the 100 years anniversary of the school, they published an extensive book with every single student in there, every address that was in there. And it's very interesting that the principal, which I knew personally, he was still alive in my days, his name was Sanctorum. He actually saved children by himself in World War II. He's a big Oy Yisrael. He's actually in Yad Vashem as one of the Hasidim Soilam. And in his office, he had carved out a hall where the main shul, which was around the corner from the school, if everybody has been to Antwerp, the main shul in Antwerp is around the corner from the school. They had taken all the Sefer Torah from there, and he had hidden it in the wall and plastered over the wall. And those Sefer Torah survived the war. So he's in Yad Vashem today, just as an aside.
Not an aside at all. This is the meat. Please, if you wouldn't mind being interviewed by me, and I would love to see a copy of that book. So I'm imagining it's the 100th anniversary of Yesod HaTorah.
There's actually students in Toronto.
1896. So it was in 1996 is what you're talking about.
1996, that's right. The school was started in...
In 1896.
Before Sarah Schneer was even
absolutely.
Then it changed into Beis Yaakov.
And then it's changed in Beis Yaakov in 1934.
There are students here in Toronto that went to the school in the 1950s. You know, Mrs. Gellis, I don't know if you know them, you know. They all went to school there.
So anybody who doesn't mind, so we have, where's Chaya right here? Chaya can interview her. I would love to see a copy of that book from 1996.
That book, it was published, yeah. It's available. It's available from the office in Antwerp. So.
Yes, thank you. Oh. We're all really related, but no, we're all sort of related. They're really related. Some more than others. Wow, thank you for that.
Questions? missed it, but I wanted to hear maybe more from Bahia or from Doctor about the history of Base Alcove in Toronto. I feel like we skipped over it very superficially. I heard you talk about Eitz Chaim.
Yeah.
And then you mentioned like a high school.
Yeah.
Was there an elementary? When did that happen?
Okay.
How did Base Alcove, we know where it is now.
Right.
I saw the three Base Alcoves that you have. But how did it start? We all know the history of time, but what was the...
So I actually, I don't have my notes with me.
My mother is here now. She's one of the first graduating classes of Base Alcove of Toronto.
So yeah, my grandmother as well was, I believe, one of the first grade 10s. I think maybe better, I'd love to talk to you afterwards. I don't want to like go into the whole thing now, which is why I sort of skated over that part. So Eitz Chaim was existing at that point. I don't know if I mentioned that it was originally an afternoon school. It transitioned to having a day school on Viewmount. At that point, so there was a grade 9 sort of on and off for both boys and girls. That was sort of like depending on the year, depending on whether they had kids. And one year they decided to have take, I think there were two girls in the grade 9 that year, and combine the grade 9 and the grade 10 to try and start a high school. Which was in that house next door to Eitz Chaim at the time. And honestly, like the gaps between that first initial house and it sort of growing, it was actually 1957, I believe, was when they bought, no, that doesn't make sense, sorry, because it didn't exist yet. Could it have been 1967? I don't know. It was quite quickly after that initial first class that they bought the building on Lawrence, which has since been renovated. And there's actually on the Ontario Jewish Archive has some really amazing photos of this delegation of visitors who came to see the new school and the pool, which is still a big part of it. There's this really amazing photo of this 1966. Thank you. Oh, the pictures are from 1966, so thank you.
And the website, don't forget to the website.
Yeah, the website's amazing. You should all check out the website.
Sorry?
The high school? No. The Base Yaakov Elementary School. Oh, yeah, the Base Yaakov Elementary School was long after. Which also, this is all coming to the website very soon, and you should all check out the website because the website is incredible, and it's getting more incredible every day. So definitely a plug for that. Thanks for the reminder. Were you asking about Base Yaakov Elementary School?
Well, I guess both.
Oh, okay.
There was a Jewish day school.
Right. Yes. Correct. Yeah. So wait, Base Yaakov High School. Public school mostly. Base Yaakov. Exactly. Right. So I don't know that I would. So my research has been focused mostly on the high school, but I wouldn't link necessarily Base Yaakov Elementary School to Base Yaakov High School in that way that you're describing, as like Base Yaakov High School being like we should have an elementary school as well, because they are independent institutions. And like I said, my focus has been mostly the high school, but my impression is that the elementary school kind of follows the same pattern that I was describing about high schools, where you start with a community only being able to sustain one school, and then it, as the community grows, people being able to open competing schools. And again, I wouldn't link the high school, Base Yaakov High School, to Base Yaakov Elementary School, and I don't know that those were connected. Please. We have that, yeah.
Okay, we're gonna get all this figured out.
Yeah, we have, we do have more of this information on, and yeah, thank you. Yeah. Oh, yeah, actually, sorry. Okay, amazing. I want to interview all of you. This is great. Really? That's fascinating. I didn't know that. So that's
eventually, when they bought the school, the building on Stormont.
Right.
Then it maybe went up to grade 3 or 4.
Yeah.
And then that little cohort.
Interesting.
The older girls joined up.
That's so interesting. There's actually this pattern.
Outsources.
Yeah, we do. There's a pattern of girls' schools developing sort of as these extensions of boys' schools and then breaking off. Actually, interestingly, there's one fun story I'll just mention quickly that in, I think it was Chicago, the reverse happened, where there was a community school and then there was a Chassidish Rebbe or son of a Rebbe there who wanted a Beis Yaakov for his daughters, and he happened to not have any sons of that age. But at some point, people were like, hey, we want our sons to have this education. So the Beis Yaakov opened a sister school for boys. So there's a certain age of boys from Chicago who went to Beis Yaakov before that school broke off and became its own thing, which is just a funny anecdote that I really enjoyed.
That. I saw that article about Beis Yaakov, and I found that so confusing.
It's so much fun, yeah.
But thank you for explaining
yeah,
that.
It's really, it's a fun fact. But, sorry, was there something? Yeah, so that's an interesting pattern. But I thought there was something I was going to say about that. But that's it. Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's lots to do. So. Right. Yeah. And also, I. Right. Yeah. Really? Oh. Really? Yeah. So that's part of the pattern, right? It's growing. And actually, the Ontario Jewish Archive has. I was just reading last night this article from the Toronto Star from I think 1974 about Beis Yaakov Elementary School, which was very new at the time, and how they were becoming recognized with the government and stuff. It's a cute article. You guys should look it up. But or I should have brought it. But it's a lot of fun. So yeah. So I think you're right. It was in the early 70s. That yeah. It was, and it did mention the Reichman. So I think yeah. But definitely. More to say, yeah, maybe there was a little more to it, but there's definitely more to say. And again, I'd love to talk to anybody. Yeah.
Okay. I wanna thank you really for a wonderful presentation, and thank everybody. And we look forward to more. And you know, it's wonderful all the talent we have in our own city. We don't know, as you were saying. And thank you very much. And b'hatzlacha as you continue on the wonderful project. Okay, everybody, have a wonderful week, and everybody be well. Okay, thank you.
David? I want to remove this, but I don't want to just yank it out. I need to click.
Yeah. Yeah,
do you know what that is?
Yes, it's this here.
Yeah.
Jack, yeah.
Okay, great, thank you.